Believe me. Hello, and welcome to the Cycle Systems Academy podcast. I'm really excited this week to invite Ryan from Ryan's Build Wheels onto the podcast. As everyone knows, I'm a complete wheel-building nut, and I've got stacks of questions. So, Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the pod.
No problem. Good to be here.
Awesome. So, you guys have got quite well known internationally, I think, especially after your video of cycling tips. But tell us a bit about yourself and about your business before we get into the wheel building mechanics.
Sure. So I guess Ryan Builds Wheels has been going for just over 7 years now. My background was actually in theatre and academia. Before that, I came to Bristol to do an MA under a director that I really digged, and to run a political street theatre company. But I'd been doing a lot of work for a cycling charity, Sustrans, here in the UK for a long time before that, both in telephone research into how and why people travel, and also as a cycle courier in several different cities. And slowly, as I realised that perhaps the odds in making a living in theatre were stacked against somebody wanting to do anarchic street theatre, I just fell more and more into the world of bikes, really, and wanted to start working in the bicycle industry. So I self-taught myself as a bike mechanic, started working in a couple of shops, volunteered for a long time for an excellent project called the Bristol Bike Project, do a lot of good work and basically bring old bikes back into service for people that need it. Eventually, I managed to get a gig at a little punky shop here in Bristol, and that was part time. I thought I'd made it. I thought it was hot shit. And then I ended up getting a full time job as a wrench at a much bigger, more professionally run store. And whilst I missed the punky days of having a doobie at the end of the day with my colleagues, that's when I realized that actually I didn't know shit. And that, yeah, working in a very fast-paced, high-end environment, I'd better buckle up and really get to learning. I was fortunate enough to work underneath an excellent head mechanic called Robin, who remains a good friend and runs his own cycle workshop here in the city now. So if anyone's in Bristol, Robin's Cycle Services, thoroughly recommend for high-end road stuff. And then, yeah, learned a lot in that year, before luckily being headhunted by somebody I'd met through the Bristol Bike Project and a bicycle festival that we used to run here in Bristol, and set up a gig venue / vegetarian vegan cafe / bike workshop called Roll for the Soul here in Bristol. And that's when it all really began. And I just started getting further and further involved in an obsession with wheels, really, before, after a few years and getting a small name for myself here in the Southwest as, you should go and chat to that guy. I think initially just because of my outright passion for them. And then it became apparent that, yeah, I should probably be doing this under my own name and starting to work for myself. And then it sort of just snowballed from there. It's been an interesting ride. In that it started out with me in the back room, as so many small businesses do. It grew and grew over the past 7 odd years until recently we did have 5 of us working as a sort of informal workers cooperative, which is the model that I prefer to work under whenever possible. Try not to. Well, we've always all been paid the same hourly rate. There's no sort of owner / worker difference in pay scale or anything like that. And then recently what we've actually done is we stripped it down to just 2 of us again, me and my business partner Pete, who runs our sort of sister company, which is called Spokes from Ryan. Because, yeah, there's some interesting side and personal projects that I'd like to realize. So we've actually stripped it back down. And I'm flying solo on the wheel building things again.
Awesome. Cool. That's quite the story. And can certainly relate to the theatre side. Don't know if many people know, but my wife and co-director, Julia, used to write and direct for the theatre. And decided to leave because you thought she'd definitely murder an actor or two at some point. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a director.
Yeah, so you could probably relate to that.
Mm.
So a lot of people listening to this podcast won't need to be told this, but maybe some do. In a world which is saturated with wheel brands, almost a new one every week, it seems, there's still a place, obviously quite a considerable one, for hand-built wheels. So why would someone want some hand-built wheels for their bike rather than literally picking one of the many, many off-the-shelf brands?
They're just better, would be the obvious place to start. But generally speaking, as many people know, if you're going to go with an off-the-shelf brand, then really what you're mostly buying in almost all cases is you're buying catalog parts, OEM parts, original equipment manufacturer, that have been supplied by a bunch of factories and then assembled and branded up. Some of those wheels are fine pieces of kit. In terms of the higher end stuff, then there are definitely a lot of skilled wheel builders working out in the East, turning out excellent product. But generally speaking, you're not getting something that's been spec'd for that rider specifically, and you're getting a bunch of parts that really anybody could get hold of. If you're going to go custom or go to a wheel builder, then unless you're going for one of our sort of what might be called a stock recipe, I've got quite a few wheel sets that I just build time and time again, and so those are available sort of immediately to go, then you can really chop and change a whole bunch of things. You know, as simple as it might sound, you can choose hub color, you can mess around with nipple color, you can choose a sturdier hub if that's what you want, you can mess around with spoke counts, you can fine tune exactly what type of spoke you're going to use depending on rider weight, intended use, etc. If you want a dynamo but you want to pair that with a branded hub at the rear, you can always do that. There's a whole bunch of things in terms of component choice. More importantly, from a technical perspective, you're almost always getting a superior product when it comes to tolerances kept for the build, and the tolerances that a wheel builder are looking at, as long as you're using high quality parts, which is another part of it, means that tolerances for how true your wheel is, that's how straight it is in either sideways or up and down in layman's terms, is going to be much straighter. But crucially, tolerances for spoke tension balance are just going to be so much higher. I've tested this against a few well-known brands, and even one of our partners that we work with for custom carbon. We work alongside an excellent company called Parcours.cc here in the UK for my road carbon offerings. And wheel building factories don't tend to keep as high a tolerance as your professional local wheel builder will for spoke tension balance, which, when it all comes down to it, that's going to affect how long that wheel lasts. So It's an investment. High spoke tension tolerances mean longer lasting spokes. And finally, to touch on that initial point I made, a wheel builder that cares isn't going to be chasing the bottom line in terms of which components they're providing you with. As long as there's the budget to work within it, and a set of good quality hand-built wheels can be had from as little as sort of $295 to $350. And of course, the limit is the sky with anything custom. But those are really good numbers compared to a lot of off-the-shelf brands who are going to be speccing lower quality components very often. A classic is hubs.
Yeah.
A lot of people always mention Hunt to us. Again, a fine product for the price you pay initially, but I find that a lot of their choice of hubs can be lacking. I think they often use hubs from a brand or a factory called Hubsmith. We prefer to use Bitex hubs. Other people and Hunt do use Bitex in some points, but generally speaking, it feels like with a factory built wheel set, the hub is the first thing that they start to slack on. And also attempt to save weight. Wheel weight is another one we could almost waffle about for a good amount of periods. But with lightweight hubs, in my experience, comes a real lack of sturdiness and durability unless you're putting the money into it.
Of course. Yep. So essentially, it's certainly something that we've noticed, as in with road bikes especially, once you start getting it at the higher end, you're getting somewhat of a replica machine of a professional racer's bike, which the professional racer's going to be, I think Nairo Quintana's 55 kilos, right? And I was reading Sean Yates's biography last night, and he mentioned a rider being a bit of a unit at 72 kilos. So if you've got a 100 kilogram rider, and lots of our, you know, military students, for example, you know, are easily, you know, that kind of size, they're buying an off-the-shelf bike with off-the-shelf wheels aimed at this generic 65, 70 kilo rider. They're going to be completely unsuitable. And what we've noticed is that that difference in spoke tension that you mentioned and the lack of consistent quality can mean a set of seemingly, you know, high quality wheels can go completely out of tension in one ride. And we've seen that with people buying brand new bikes while they're on the course, going for a ride on Dartmoor, coming back, and the spokes are pretty much falling out because they've detensioned on the ride. So I'd certainly, you know, really, really empathize with that.
Yeah, so, I've seen that kind of thing happening an awful lot. And I would say that actually one of my favorite tasks is building wheels for what I call heavier, more powerful riders. I love how being able to build something that can actually take the power that these people are able to put through through the frame of the wheels, it just opens up cycling in terms of accessibility. And I like to be able to guide people through or to provide something that means that they have some faith in the equipment underneath them. Whereas, again, like you say, if you jump on a bike that you just bought and you're all excited to get out and you go like, oh, I'm going to go for my first ride, and things fail on you. The issue is that very often I think the psychology and the emotional side of it comes back to the rider, and it's within cycling sometimes we're made to feel that it might be the rider's fault, you know, that they're too heavy, you know, maybe I shouldn't be cycling. And it's just bullshit. I've built wheels for riders up to and including 185 kilograms. And they're still going strong. And to be able to open cycling up as a pastime or a mode of transport for somebody who most likely has been told by society that, hey, you can't ride a bike, is just really nice and powerful.
And also, I think a lot of people don't realize when they buy a bike, and this includes the wheels, is what they're buying into in terms of the service requirements. So on one of the bike mechanics' Facebook pages yesterday, there was the all too common picture now of a head tube with all of these cables, wires and hydraulic hoses coming out of it. And the guy's like, I'm doing a fork swap and it's taking 90 minutes.
Yeah, I saw that.
2 minutes. And of course, there's all the usual posts of what charge for your time. And someone wrote a really considered reply saying, well, I don't think the people really know what they're buying into when they buy that bike, and they don't realize they're going to have these high costs. And it's often the same with high-end wheels, isn't it, Ryan, that you're going to have proprietary hubs, proprietary spokes, sometimes even proprietary nipples and rims. So when something gets damaged, then literally, especially at the moment, if the spares aren't available, and
you're left dead in the water.
Completely. And certain wheel companies, no names mentioned, are terrible at supplying spares anyway.
Oh, I'll name them.
Yeah.
Mavic and Fulcrum can go do one.
Absolutely. Yeah. They've got a special customer service, I think, where it's like, do not answer the telephone. Never answer your emails.
And not only are those spares potentially not available for modern wheel sets, but you try getting spares for what you might call a legacy product, just forget about it. They're just not available. And it is about education as well. A lot of customers might ask, oh, you know, can we rebuild these? And then you have to go, well, no, not really, because certain parts are proprietary. Those parts are what need replacing. The interface, very often, in terms of a good example, would be spoke, rim, and nipple interface. You know, that interface is done in a not a strange way, but a way that is almost surely designed just for marketing and to make servicing the damn thing less less possible. And you have to sort of declare, no, I'm afraid it's dead. You were sold something that was designed to die from the very start. This is these companies want. They want it to die. They want you to buy some new ones and for that cycle to continue. Whereas obviously when using commonly available components of high quality, you're not going to have that problem. If it does break, which it's not gonna when it's built properly, or when it reaches the end of its serviceable life in 5-10 years time, if not more, then hey, you can rebuild. And with the advent and popularity of disc brakes, of course, as long as your rims remain in good shape, those are kind of wheels for life. Sure, they might need respoking after many thousands of miles. I think we're 7 years in and we haven't seen a single fatigued spoke as of yet, which is quite nice. A good example would be that I give a 10-year guarantee on any builds using higher end bladed spokes, for example. I feel confident that that's something that you can give. And, you know, where else do you get people saying, hey, have a decade's worth of guarantee. If it goes wrong, I'll fix it.
Yeah. Especially, you know, I'm sure lots of people listening to this, just like myself, have been out on a club run, you know, on the road bikes and seen spokes just break, just fail, and, you know, certain brands more than others. So you're saying there now about the disc brakes, and obviously that's something, whether people have liked it or not, has, you know, been forced upon us, just like CDs over vinyl, as it were, and it's become the norm. So I'm assuming a huge amount of the wheels you build are disc wheels now. Although obviously there's still rim brake bikes out there. One of the things that's always kind of bugged me a bit is a real question about lacing with disc brakes, because obviously we're teaching people. So people come to us not knowing anything about wheel building. And we do 2 days of wheel building on level 2 just to get the basics in. And then we've got a couple of days on advanced wheel building on level 3. And then if they're passionate, they can buy kit and, you know, keep on experimenting. And when we're teaching, we teach, you know, very much the Shimano way of lacing. So on a front disc wheel, we teach that both sets of outboard spokes need to face forwards to resist the torsional force of the disc. Mm-hmm. And on a rear, the non-drive side face forward to resist the disc torsional force, and the drive side backwards to resist the drive torsional force, even though that's less. And that seems to make sense to me. But what we've noticed ever since we started, you know, really looking at this, is that there are certain companies that emphatically don't agree with that. Chris King, I think, would be one of the most famous, where they say the non-disc side on the front hub doesn't matter on the lacing. And then we also see all sorts of wheel sets from quite established builders, not hand builders, but quite established brands, and coming with quite established bikes, which break this rule. And there are certain wheel builders that say, hey, it doesn't matter. It's only a couple of mil. But my take has always been, well, you may as well build the most resistance to breakage into a wheel, because you don't know who's riding it and what use. But I've always wondered, well, you know, are we just doing it wrong? Are these companies who are just selling wheels that are laced the same for front or rear disc and on disc, are they doing it right, or are we teaching it right?
Now, this is something I'm a little bit passionate about, because I do fall into one of the latter caps that you mentioned. But to give you an example, I build the same way that you teach, and from a purely theoretical point of view, then I'm quite happy to suggest that it is the correct way. You're gaining more of a bracing angle on spokes that are taking torque, and then theoretically and according to going by the book, then yeah, those are going to be more resistance to the forces that both drive and braking present. I did a lot of sort of reading into and thinking about and chatting to other people and going, you know, which is the right way? Because, you know, then Chris King pops up. A popular way of looking at it is for people to say, hey, you know what? I'm pretty sure that Shimano have a fair few more people working on these problems than Chris King, purely because of the company size.
Yeah.
But after thinking about it, after doing a lot of teaching as well, the way I like to explain this to say, hey, look, here's what I feel makes the most theoretical sense as a professional outfit, then I like to build in a way that I've got a backup. Should anyone, you know, if I put a wheel out there and someone was going, hey, this isn't built correctly, it's, oh, I'm really disappointed in this. I prefer to not deal with those people. But after more than a decade of doing this kind of stuff and thinking about it and looking at it, likewise, I have seen from shitty brands, reputable brands, high-end brands, my own builds, builds from friends, build from other high-end wheel builders, factory builds, every which. I've seen them laced every which way. And I have attempted to keep track, at least subconsciously, of spokes that seem to be breaking prematurely. And I just don't see a pattern. I haven't seen any particular form of lacing. I'm happy to hear reports to the contrary, but I just don't see any of those different ways of lacing when it comes to whether your inbound or your outbound spokes are leading or trailing. I've never seen anything saying, hey, this way breaks more spokes compared to others. And I am quite happy to stick it on the record that I have come to the conclusion that it doesn't matter if you're building your own wheels and you're building them to high tolerances and you're getting your tension balance correct and you haven't chosen a shitty combination of components that give you poor bracing angles, etc., then don't worry about it. It's not a detail that's worth sweating. I feel it's worthwhile doing it the Shimano way if you want to be theoretically correct. And again, I like to have respect for my customers, so we'll always build wheels in that way. But yeah, I've not seen a difference. There is, of course, I am thinking about changing how I build rear wheels, simply because whilst I build the outbound to take the torque forces of the drive sprockets, as you discussed at the start, what I'm actually seeing is I'm seeing, as we see more people new to cycling, realizing that hand-built wheels can be an excellent purchase, what we're actually seeing is more chains being dropped into rear drive side spokes. And that's because maybe the machines aren't as well maintained as they need to be, or that people are riding a hell of a lot right now and not going for service intervals. And you're seeing that chain suck occur. And if you lace with your outbound spokes on the drive side as your leading spokes, then one of the plus sides there is the chain suck doesn't bite into the spokes the tighter the chain gets between the cassette and the cog, between the cassette and the spokes, sorry. And I'm actually thinking about switching that, simply because one of the most common repairs I have to make is the odd rider who's jammed a chain into their spokes, everything needs replacing, or you know that they're going to die a death at some point. The spokes, that is, not the rider.
Well, all the
I mean,
riders,
we all are.
Yeah, all the riders will at some point.
We all will. We can't escape that fact. But I'd rather it wasn't because their spokes broke after they destroyed them using their chains.
I'm into that, yeah. I mean, certainly the drive side torsional force, sorry guys, it's always going to be the least powerful, isn't it? And you know, certainly I remember building up a zip rim with some Hope RS4 hubs, and they've got quite a large flange on the drive side. And it was, I think, 20 hole rims. So you could do a one cross or two cross. And the two cross would have been ideal in terms of the bracing angles, but the flange wouldn't allow it. So built it one cross. And it might look not quite technically correct, but actually those wheels rode great, absolutely fine. Maybe it wouldn't if Chris Hoy was sprinting on them. But yeah, so I completely understand. Now, again, you've been very much led into the next question, Ryan, which was about component selection. So we'll talk about which components that you favour and why shortly, because the market for that has been quite, it's evolved a lot over the last couple of decades that I've been doing it. But essentially, when you buy a wheel from a big manufacturer, they have hopefully anyway engineered the hub, the spokes, the rim, everything to work together. You know, whereas just like on a bike where you've got a group set from one manufacturer and a frame from another and wheels on another, if you're hand building wheels, these are all different components that aren't necessarily designed to work together. So a wheel builder can have a tremendous symphony of harmony or a complete clusterfuck, depending on what they choose. So how do you choose different components in order to work together? And what is it you're looking for both to succeed and avoid?
I think that it's hard to get a real shit show of components, as you say. There's a lot of good stuff from well-respected brands out there these days. And as long as you're following some basic guiding principles, then most things tend to be good. Because thankfully, when it comes to your standard spoked wheel, for once, standards do exist, and we've not changed those standards within the industry for quite some time. You know, wire spokes that are going to be anything from 15 through to 13 gauge, they're going to fit most hubs. Most hubs are drilled similarly. Spoke holes within rims aren't massively different. And as long as you're not deciding to do insane things in terms of your lacing patterns, then there's not going to be too big of a problem. So the real key for me always lies in seeking quality first, rather than, as we've talked about, going to that bottom line when it comes to cost of components. And I like to talk about a brand called Bitex here. A lot of people wouldn't have heard of Bitex, but they're one of my most popularly used hubs. And they're a superlative manufacturer based out in Taiwan. And for the money, their hubs are very good indeed. Other people might have heard of Novatec, but I'd more rather spec a Bitex hub time and time again. The machining tolerance is good. Bearing quality as supplied is always great. And they have, you know, good lightweights for those that need them. They've got excellent and progressive geometries when it comes to flange spacing and flange sizes. They've got multiple hubs that are available with a whole range of spoke counts and potentially steel rather than an aluminium axle for riders that need them, and so on and so forth. And outside of that, then my most popular options would tend to be Hope or DT Swiss, but of course it's hard to find. I feel it's hard to find a bum component unless you're going super cheap. Carbon rims are a kind of good example of that. I would like to hear, if you've got one, an example of a shit show of a bunch of components, because I don't see them too often, luckily.
Well, what we've seen is people reaching for cool things and not thinking of how they work together. So one specific example I can remember, and this was way back when we were starting Cycle Systems, funnily enough, and there was a mechanic who's now a very well-known frame builder, and he just went, that's cool, that's cool, that's cool, because there was just stuff in the warehouse where they were available. And it was a really nice hub, can't quite remember what it was, some sort of deep section rim, and some revs, some DT Revolution spokes, you know, some super light spokes, which are 1.5 mil for the most part of the body. And the deep section rim was so stiff that as soon as he got on the bike and pedaled off down Brick Lane, the wheel flexed unbelievably because the rim was too stiff for the spokes, essentially. And this was, of course, in the days of rim brakes for pretty much everyone when people were riding brakes anyway. So it was just completely unsuitable. So that was the most dramatic example of someone who built a wheel with really good quality components, which was so not designed to work together that the bike was unrideable.
And potentially this would have been just as 11 speed came in.
Yeah.
Right, there you go. So that is one thing that I see quite often.
Yeah.
I'd say that the most common, yes, you're right, the most common cause of incorrect components comes in not having that basic understanding of wheel design. And mostly that comes down to bracing angles. The the difference in angles between each drive side and non-drive sides spokes as they come out of the flange and towards the rim. So bracing angles is one thing, and then spoke entry angle into the rim is something that needs to be not carefully considered, but one needs to be aware of it. And of course, with the advent of 11 speed, what we saw, and we're going to continue seeing this as I assume we're going to either end up with deeper cassettes or hopefully thinner gearing. Anyway, I'm going on a tangent. But what your rider with the deep dish may have seen was, especially seeing as it was a rim brake build, it was going to have had quite a difference in bracing angles. So his drive side spokes would have been at the correct tension and a high tension at that. Whereas very, very likely those non-drive side spokes would have been very low in tension. The deep dish would have helped. But yeah, those spokes are just going to come loose quite quickly. A classic one for me would be, if we're going to talk about poor choices of components, it's often also, I find, people attempting to take an older school understanding of what parts are good and attempting to use them these days. So a classic build that I will consistently say, really don't recommend. Someone might say, hey, I'd like some, you know, Shimano 105 hubs or any hub with even sized flanges on a really shallow rim, such as the old school Mavic Open Pro, which back in its day was an excellent rim and well regarded and so on and so forth. But as soon as 11 speed comes in, you get an insanely low spoke tension on a rim that shallow with bracing angles as different as they are on 11 speed. And for the money, there's just better rims available. So people haven't considered that potentially they might want a deeper rim, as we just discussed, which will improve bracing angles. We've also now got the ability with many rims on the market that a lot of high-end builders use to spec an offset rim, whereby the rim's spoke bed is offset in a way that allows each of those two bracing angles from the hub to be a little more even. And then that can help an awful lot as well.
Mm-hmm. And that really shows, doesn't it, that the market really has to keep growing and evolving. And it really has, hasn't it? Because, you know, only a few years ago, in terms of rims, you'd be looking at DT Swiss or Mavic and hubs. Yeah, there were still quite a few hub manufacturers out there, but there's so much more now. And that did lead me to the next question, as in terms of, you know, say, looking at almost pre-internet days, but certainly pre-Alibaba days, everything you were buying went through a supply chain with quality control, you'd hope anyway. So quality control from the manufacturer right through to consumer rights acts and things there to protect people. Although when we saw what happened with carbon clincher rims for rim brakes, that all seemed to be nonsense because that was fucking dangerous and should never have seen the light of day for a single set of those wheels. But what now, when people can just buy direct from the factory in the Far East, there is that concern of quality and of quality control, especially carbon catastrophically failing, etc. So do you think that the marketplace is a better place because of the amount of choice? Is it more confusing for the customer? And are there real dangers out there for people buying components online that aren't suitable for use?
I don't see too many people buying maybe I don't see them because they're dead. I don't see too many people purchasing hubs, aluminium rims or spokes online from sites such as Alibaba. I do prefer to obviously stick with distributors in the trade because I know that they've been sourcing direct from a manufacturer. And carbon's the interesting one. Very occasionally somebody will turn up with some cheaper carbon, which has been sourced almost certainly not direct from the manufacturer. And that can be an issue, especially when, as you say, it sticks to rim brakes. But generally speaking, to stick on the carbon front a minute, something good has happened with carbon these days. And I'm pretty happy to say that if you're buying from a known manufacturer, then it's really hard to find a bum carbon rim. You'd have to be going really cheap. Mm-hmm. To find something that's not doesn't meet the basic needs of safety these days. It might not be the best for build or finish or QC, etc., but they tend to be pretty good unless there's old school tech involved.
I don't mean to cut in there, but I was just really interested. This is jumping forward to a later question, but it feels pertinent. What about road tubeless safety? Because we have got these new ISO standards now. But if you're buying some sort of generic, you know, rim online, do you think that's consistent as well?
If it was generic, I'd want to have a big question mark above that. There's going to be a few manufacturers out there working with that, but it's not actually something that I've had to think too much about. As of yet, simply because I tend to keep my carbon offerings to a select few, because of issues like that. And I will happily build with rims that people have bought me unless I decide that they're junk and say, I'm sorry, I'm simply not going to touch these, which is very rare. But interestingly, I think from where I'm sat, it's actually there's something going on. Sociologically, with the riders who occasionally provide me with cheaper self-sourced carbon, and they're not really interested in tubeless. So it's not actually a question I've had to answer as of yet.
Cool. So just coming on then, we'll get back into the biotech substitute shortly, because I was reading about them on your website earlier. Two out of the last four podcast guests, so John Paul Ballard from Swiss Side and Xavier Disney from AeroCoach, have really, really dissed hookless carbon rims for road riders, especially for performance road riders. So, like, look, if you want to ride 70 PSI or less, fine. But for a lot of performance riders, which obviously are their customers, it's not so great. I think Zab even said nonsense. So what's your take on the hookless for road?
I think I'm going to start from where I lie on. Let's talk about hooked tubeless momentarily.
Yep.
And both from my customer's point of view and the feedback I get there and my own personal experience, I currently lie within the camp that at the thinner 25s, 28s, etc., sizes that are more commonly seen on a lot of machines or more commonly chosen, I do feel that we should be going a little bit wider when it comes to tire choice these days. Whilst I wanted to be convinced, I just don't remain convinced of road tubeless at higher PSIs. I started to see a lot of my customers and riders suffering sidewall punctures that they just couldn't get to seal, even with my favorite brand of tubeless sealant. And even knowing everything was set up correctly, sidewall punctures were just leaving people stranded. I personally got stranded along a ridiculous section of the National Cycle Network, which I just shouldn't have taken on a road bike. That's kind of my fault. Just not something that I can quite yet recommend. I don't feel the tech is there, or I feel that we really want to be riding 32 upwards and lower pressures when it comes to hooked tubeless. And as such, I just can't see hookless being a great idea at those kind of whips as of yet. Simply because of reliability right now. I think a lot of people are probably wanting to talk about the reliability of those tires staying on. And as of yet, because it's only something that's relatively recently come into the field, it's not something that I've seen many people going for. But my eyebrows have definitely raised when I've seen it as a potential. And sometimes these things, well, let's talk about carbon plus a minute. What's the easiest way to save weight on a carbon rim? Well, one of the easiest ways is to make it hookless.
Exactly.
And what sells wheels very often? Weight. Very often, yeah, we can go back to talking about the lower quality, lighter hubs that we see, and also that headline title of these wheels weigh this much, or this little, as the case may be. And that often, for the general public, seems to be the thing that sells most products, is, hey, it weighs this much. Even though most riders really don't want lightweight wheels, they want to be gaining an aerodynamic advantage of a suitably deep, suitably profiled, high-end carbon wheel, for those of us that are serious about things like that, or at least just want to have the best wheels available to us. So my initial, yeah, I've been wary, and I'm aware of and skeptical of the reasonings behind it.
Yeah, and that's certainly been my take, and obviously many of our podcast's guests as well. So it's nice to hear that. And certainly, you know, our friends at Cycling Tips, as we know, that for the road bikes, they're Team Tube Inside. And James Wang has been on the record several times, and Kaylee, saying 40 mil upwards and 40 mil below is great for tubeless. So, you know, that's, you know, maybe quite extreme, you know, but certainly that's their take on it. So coming back to the components then, like I said, there is almost an overwhelming choice of equipment. And of course, wheel building requires lots of specialist tools, and regular listeners to the podcast know that I'm out in Switzerland, so I'm a long way from my workshop, although I did visit recently and I'm coming back to Devon soon to go to the academy again. So I've got no wheel building tools beyond bespoke key with me at the moment. And I'm looking for another set of wheels for my bike. I've got my lovely Swisside Aero wheels for my bike, but they're not the lightest, and want some serious climbing wheels as well. And the first thing I did was to contact you. And that's how this podcast got set up. So I'm like, I want a set of decent wheels. I don't want to spend necessarily 3,000-4,000 euros on a set of wheels. And I spoke to you because of your expertise in the market, and as well, obviously, your skill of building. If I can't build the wheels myself, then I want someone building it who really, really is going to be good and who really knows the components. So in terms of your knowledge of what's out there, is this simply one through trial and error? Or have you got other ways where you're finding out about, you know, what's on the market and what works and what doesn't?
The wheel building community tends to be quite open when it comes to people working professionally. Especially when I started out probably 7 or 8 years ago, then it was wonderful to have a bunch of people doing similar things to me who you can bounce ideas back and forth, etc. And there hasn't been too much trial and error, fortunately, because you can chat to people. There are a few brands that I find too finicky that I tend not to work with these days, because I think that they're a little bit too specialist for most riders' needs, and I see that they're going to require a little bit more care and attention than one might want. But now, generally speaking, my way of looking at wheels is often very theory based. As long as I've got a bunch of components that I know to be good, then after that, it'll come down to hole counts, bracing angles, spoke type, etc. I mean, a good example, just looking at our discussion about your super light pair of climbing wheels now, you know, I went straight for one of my favorite hubs, as we talked about. We went, you know, the Bitex hubs would do it for a really good price. And then as soon as you want to start really shaving weight off, The hub is one of the places to start, and I recommended a super light hub from a manufacturer down in Italy. And there's a couple of other super lightweight component manufacturers who a lot of people might use, but one of them especially, whilst I really enjoy their products, I've just found the hubs I see give people a few more problems than I'd like to see due to the way that preload is set up. It's something, you know, something as in-depth or inconsequential as how a hub deals with bearing preload versus another one. There have been a few experiences like that whereby I'll choose to switch out a specialist product for another. In this case, super lightweight hubs. I tend to go with the Italians rather than the Germans in this case.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
So the thing that starts Jackie Chan punch-ups in the workshop and online is all about lubing spoke threads.
Okay.
Something that, you know, I've had an evolving attitude to. And I actually had an incredible discussion with Scott Dudenbach from the Bike Shop Show about this as well, which I really appreciated. And I'll paraphrase it in a minute. But essentially, when I learned wheel building, it was from Teresa Webb originally from the Bike Inn when I did my training there way, 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 way back when. And the Bike Inn method was to use breast nipples and never, ever move the threads. And in fact, there was quite a good time trialist on the course with us at the time. And he said, yeah, I bought a set of wheels off a well-known wheel builder from the time I was in a race and my front wheel just collapsed underneath me and I fell off. And Teresa said, yeah, that's because he lubed his threads and the nipples come undone. So I was kind of religious in that anti-nipple lubing brigade. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in my Punky Bike Co-op days in Oxford, I learned a tremendous amount of wheel building. There's a guy called Gary Moja who worked with for a time, mm-hmm. who he said, Sean, what are you doing? He said, you're fighting the wheel. He mm-hmm. said, watch this. And he built a wheel that kind of built itself.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And now the way we teach is a kind of hybrid of Teresa Webb and Gary Moja methods with other things we've learned along the way. But one of the things he did in that build is he lubed all the threads. And I saw that wheel come back to the shop in about a week and it was completely pissed.
Interesting.
It was all like, it'd come undone. Okay. And then, of course, we see there are people who say, okay, the nipples do come undone. So we're going to put some Loctite on the end of the threads to stop it. And there's all of this clusterfuck of different, you know, opinions and such. So I said to Scott Dinnenberg, what do you think? Because I completely respect you as a wheel builder. And he said, well, you know, Sean, for people that just want to ride their bikes, I'll do brass nipples, no lube, and they can just ride. And people like me, meaning Scott, who don't mind tinkering with their bikes and retensioning their wheels every week, I'm happy to lube and use aluminium nipples if they want. And I thought, oh, that's a nice answer. But every good wheel builder I speak to, I just want to open my brain and say, what do you think?
So we're specifically talking about the lubrication of spoke thread as opposed to nipple and rim interface, correct?
Yes, and the nipple material choice, you know, thereof, because obviously aluminium is going to seize onto steel without the lube.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I am a thread lubricator. Turning up at Thread Lubricators Anonymous here. And also, I do use a very lightweight wicking thread lock at the end of my build process, but not for the reasons you might think. I'm also a proponent for alloy nipples, which seems to be, again, that's just a, that's just a, it just turns into such an ongoing argument online and sometimes into real life. I'm going to talk about alloy nipples first, simply because I feel that there's a lot of old school misinformation out there, and it's to do with them being built correctly. I'm going to say that a website called Wheel Fanatic, run by a chap called Rick, who used to run Wheelsmith Spokes over in the States, has an excellent blog about working efficiently with alloy nipples. And in the past, alloy nipples were problematic. There was a lot of cheap junk out there, and we would see failures. We'd see a lot of corrosion, and you know, we've a lot of people working professionally or even with their own wheels will have seen really bad quality alloy nipples just corroding away into a fine white dust of aluminium oxide that just flakes off, and it's horrible. But I've got a massive brand loyalty here, and use Sapim's nipples almost exclusively.
Yep.
Their nipples are both heat treated. They are made from a less common option of 7075 alloy rather than some of the 6000 series that I believe gets more commonly used by other manufacturers. They're hard anodized afterwards, and according to Sapim, there's some sort of special surface treatment, blah, blah, blah. But I've never had any issues with them, and I've been using them for many a year. One thing that is vital to understand is that, yes, alloy is a more brittle material versus brass, and when built with insufficient spoke thread, then you are going to see it snap, even those Sapim nipples that I so love. If there's not enough spoke thread engagement above and beyond what I'm going to call the shoulder of the spoke, where the ball joint most commonly starts, then that's going to shear off, end of story. So spoke length is critical for alloy nipples, and indeed brass nipples. But you know, I've seen badly built wheels with brass nipples and not enough spokes last for quite some time anyway. Then when it comes to thread lubrication, I started lubricating threads because I didn't want to be fighting those wheels. As you say, it's critical that an aluminium thread is going to be lubricated if used on a steel thread. And I just want to avoid that demon of spoke wind-up, which still has to be accounted for with a variety of methods or tools. But I didn't want to fight those wheels. And additionally, because a lot of my riders ride in all conditions and they ride quite hard, I wanted to provide a degree of weatherproofing. And in chats with Rick, I eventually settled on a specific hydraulic fluid, actually, from the food industry that we use on all of our builds, and it's the same product as Rick's clear oil that he's got up on his website. I might release it at some point in the future, but I've been using it for ages, and I'm happy to say to other people, hey, you know what, a little bit of a small drop of a chain lube wouldn't go amiss. But again, once wheels are built up to a sufficient tension and have been stress relieved, one of the reasons that you see a lot of wheels coming loose post build, I believe, is simply because they've not been stress relieved enough. And so that tends to happen when the rider gets on the bike. And a well-built wheel should never be hearing that the builder wants it back in a couple of weeks as they can check it. You know, spokes shouldn't be pinging when you start riding. That sound of spin pinging is that spoke twist coming out of the spokes. And as that spoke twist comes out, then things go out of balance, stuff becomes untrue, then you have the potential for it to start unwinding, as you said. And some people will say that, hey, you know, It'll hold together via tension. Well, that's where I come in saying that I have never seen any of my wheels, and indeed, and I also see most other wheel builders working at the in a similar working at a similar level and production levels to myself, will lubricate threads and nipple interfaces with no issues. So for me, it's based very much on experience, and a lot of experience across a lot of wheels. And I've never seen a lubricated, well-built wheel come loose.
Certainly, you know, one of our recent instructors, Gavin, who'd worked at a really high-end road shop locally to us, he was very much off that take. So I'd get lube them up, and he was a massive fan of the Sapim Pro-Lock nipples as well. You know, and Sapim actually have supported Cycle Systems since the beginning, so it's worth mentioning that. So thanks for that insight. It's really fascinating. So
no worries. I would like to, sorry to interrupt there again. I just eagle-eared listeners will point out that I did briefly touch on the fact that there is a small drop of wicking thread locker that goes into wheels at the end. And some people will say, we'll get riled up and go, oh, you know, a well-built wheel should never require a thread locker. And I do want to go on the record and say they're right. They're absolutely correct. The thread locker in our case isn't actually there to guarantee that a wheel stays tensioned and straight. It's part of the weatherproofing system. So one of the reasons that I do lubricate nipples as well and threads is that weatherproofing and corrosion inhibition. So what tends to happen for my wheels, well, what does happen, is that lubrication that we just discussed, that gets placed from the, let's say, the slotted side of your standard nipple once the spoke is already slightly threaded in there. So lubrication goes inside. As those spoke threads come up into the nipple thread, they become lightly lubricated, but the first threads of the nipple are actually unlubricated. Once the build is complete, then what that allows is you can now use this very lightweight wicking Loctite. It's not a Loctite, it's a thread locker. And that gets dropped into the opposing side of the nipple, the side nearest the hub. And what that does is it wicks down into those dry threads that were already inhabited by spoke material to start with until it meets the lubricant. And then it backs up a little bit. And whilst that gives a tiny amount of a thread lock, it's still absolutely chewable in the future. But crucially, what I use it for is it forms a little plug within the nipple, a little sort of plasticized plug where it backs up. And so what it's there for actually is as a form of weatherproofing and to stop grit and water ingress going into your spoke threads and creating corrosion in the future. I might have to make a little blog post or a diagram about that. Interestingly, I've shared that with a few people, and it works very well. I know my friend David in the Southeast, they use that. And I have seen having serviced and dismantled wheels from an excellent UK manufacturer who make great hubs and other stuff. I've then had a pair of their wheels in, someone saying, hey, can we put a different rim on this because I'm changing wheel size? And lo and behold, I've opened, you know, those spokes and nipples up, I've dismantled it and found, hey, look at that. There's a little plug of material right here. And it seems that it's started to find its way into other people's workshops and operations as well, which is nice.
That's awesome. Whenever I learn something exciting new about wheel building, I get a little warm feeling. So thanks for that. It's brilliant.
I can send some down to Cycle Systems. I'll send a little instruction sheet, and I can send some of those two products, which we had to buy in large quantities, and still might be released at some point. I can send some down for you to experiment with.
Oh, fantastic. Well, if anyone listening is going to be on the December level 2, then you'll be able to play with those. That's fantastic. So thank you, Ryan. That's really generous. So looking at spokes then, obviously there's been, you know, lots of different types of spokes out there. And one of the things we spoke about was these bird spokes, B-E-R-D. And to people that remember, you know, the various failures from Spinergy and such, they had some sort of polyfiber spoke, didn't they? And I think one of the very first websites ever built was set up to sue Spinergy for all of their failed wheels. They look a bit scary, these bird poly-like spokes. I think I first heard about them in the hill climbing world. But you recommended them, so you obviously rate them. So have you built wheels with these bird spokes, and what are they like?
I have not. So this is where this is your time to get slightly scared. If we went ahead with that build, this would actually be my first time using them. I'd be building a pair before yours as a test. I have had my eyes on bird spokes for a while. There's also another brand called Pi Ropes. I don't know how they compare and contrast. I'd want to talk to some other people. But they've intrigued me for a long time. I think at the core of things, I'm more of a spoke nerd than a wheel nerd. A lot of the time, I just love the magic of how that pre-stressed tension balance structure that is a bike wheel exists through thin bits of wire, be they steel or be they other materials in this case. And I'd like to name drop Pete Owen of Owen Wheels in London. For my confidence in recommending that product. He's been using them a long time. I'm also going to look up Zed Wheels. It's a chap that I've not met as of yet, but he's been doing an awful lot with bird spokes and turning out some excellent lightweight wheels. And although I've not met the chap behind Zed, I've been following his work for a while, and I've known Pete Owen of Owen Wheels ever since I began, and been very happy with his output and trust him implicitly. He very much knows what he's talking about. And so I've just become intrigued by them. We talked about wheel weight earlier and how it's often something that people chase. And really, you've only got a few places to shave that weight off.
Yep.
And all things considered, I'd said earlier that ideally most of us want to be chasing an aerodynamic profile. All things considered, there's only a few places where you can safely and reliably start shaving that weight away. The hub is one of the most common places, as discussed earlier, and as discussed with a lot of wheel brands creating lightweight wheels or wheels that seem to have a lightweight, it's often the hub where those savings have been made, which leads to lack of reliability. So the hub that I've recommended for you, if you wanted to go higher end, obviously comes with a cost. You're looking at about 650 quid a pair, compared to hubs which are only marginally lighter, only marginally heavier from, again, manufacturers like Bitex. But again, hub weight has very little bearing on wheel performance. It's not spinning massively. There's very little centrifugal force going on, and it's not going to change the feel of the wheels very much in terms of their handling or how quickly they might be able to spin up. It has, to talk technically for a moment, the hub has very, 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 very little effect on a wheel's moment of inertia. An MOI is something that you can set up a very simple test rig to measure a wheel. So then we're left with really only two other sets of components. We can save weight at the rim, which is the best place to save weight, so long as our rim is of suitable quality and does what it's going to need. And again, there's only so far you can push rim technology. We've talked very briefly about hookless and the attempt of weight saving there, which feels like until tire and rim manufacturers start chatting properly and making sure that there's a safety standard involved in that, which they are, we're going to want to keep an eye on that for a while. But there's only so much we can push rim technology. certain rims can only take a certain amount of pressure as well. I've seen a few rims blowing out when they're too light.
Yep.
And in aluminium, there have been a few well-documented cases of brands just attempting to get too light, really pushing that boundary, and then finding that they've gone a little bit too far, and coming back with a lot of rim failures, spoke holes cracking and the such, yeah. Which obviously isn't good for anybody, especially when you're trying to sell wheels with a 10-year guarantee. And so finally, of course, we're left with spokes and nipples. So again, we come back to alloy nipples, absolutely fine with that, got no problem using those, as long as they're of sufficient quality. And then we've seen, you know, the SAPIM CX rayers for a long time, and for a long time onwards, I believe, will remain the gold standard for something that's relatively high end and has a price tag attached to it, but performs very well, and that or a similar spoke from similar brands will do an excellent job. We've started to see people like SAPIM creating the super spoke a little while ago, which again is a very thin spoke. They've been using a different blend of steel this time around, but we haven't seen that enter the market massively. And in fact, it tends to only be offered to a couple of brands over in Germany, and sometimes leaks into the market. But that's not something that we've seen coming out a lot. Titanium spokes can be a little bit lighter, but a lot of people say that they're quite stretchy. I don't see many quality butted titanium spokes on the market. And then, yeah, so finally we come along to, hey, well, how can we shave a bit of weight off the spokes? We come to the idea of high-end fiber spokes, such as Bird's Case.
Yeah.
And we're able to shave off, you know, in a... The build that you and I have been discussing only uses 24 spokes front and rear, which is pretty much as low as many people would want to get for a disc brake wheel. And straight away, you know, we're able to shave off close to 90 grams, which in wheel terms, especially when we're talking about wheel sets weighing, you know, weighing about 1,100 grams, then, you know, shaving off 90 grams is pretty impressive. It's 10%.
Yeah.
And so we do have to be careful of constantly chasing diminishing returns and not going for a component that is going to, the word I'm looking for isn't currently available to me. It's not going to impact the durability of the build. That's why the bird spokes interest me. I've seen plenty of people using them. They work in the same way as any other tensioned piece of wire. They seem durable, and I've not seen any reports of failure. So at some point, I've definitely got to use them for something. I'm likely going to get a bunch in just to build a pair of wheels for the experience, and yep. I certainly would before I dealt with them for any customers. But yeah, they do excite me. I've not had the time to make it happen yet.
Okay. Well, I'm still weighing up my options while I get the money together to get those wheels from you. So probably before the spring, before the lightweight wheels come out, then I'll have made a decision and I'll report back, guys. So, Ryan, we're talking wheels, and I feel like I could learn so much from you. It's like I feel we could just talk for many, many, many hours. But podcast listeners do have a kind of limit for this sort of show. So I think we need to wrap it up there, but maybe we can talk again in the future. And just before we go, we were on video before we started. You're rocking the Mohican, you've got acoustic guitar on the wall behind you. So I've got to ask, what music's rocking your workshop right now?
I've been listening to a lot of King Gizzard and the Wizard Lizard. who are an Australian psych band. They're fantastic. Yep. They might be called the Lizard Wizard or the Wizard Lizard.
Okay.
King Ivor. Yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff recently. VOCs are another excellent psychedelic rock band that I've been into for a while. But really, I'd say what's rocking mostly is the fact that our workshop is also our rehearsal and gig space. And a bunch of us have just started playing together this past year or so when we've been allowed to. And for many of us, it's been the first time that we've ever actually played with other musicians. And whilst our output is by no means of the highest quality and we're only doing the odd little bit of a cover here and there, that's been the thing that's excited me most is finally playing with other people and making music myself.
Awesome. Well, amen to that. And actually, as soon as we finish recording, I'm actually going to go and grab my pipes and have a bit of a jam with our neighbours. Our neighbours, we found a musician. So we've actually got a little neighbourhood band together. And apparently we're going to do some sort of gig at Christmas.
We're going to do the same. Yeah, it's going to be great. Yeah,
great stuff. So here is to community. Here is to people. Here is to music. And here is to riding bikes on the best possible wheels for you. So Ryan, I'm sure everyone listening is inspired not only to learn more about wheel building, but maybe to buy some wheels like I am. So where can people find you online?
Easy to find us, www.ryanbuildswheels.co.uk is us. And if you're not in the UK or you're a bit further from us, there's a lot of excellent wheel builders working at excellent levels of expertise. And I can thoroughly recommend your nearest local wheel builder who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, that's the caveat. Yeah. And I think you might have a bit of PTSD from internet forums from the way you've described people picking up on all of the little details. It is one of those worlds where whatever you do, someone's going to say it's wrong. But of course, you know, I invite anyone to come on the podcast and contradict anything Ryan said. I've certainly learned so much just in this hour talking. So Ryan, fantastic to speak to you. You know, thanks so much for your time. I'll let you get back to the workshop and the gig space and whatever else you're up to today. And everyone listening, we'll be back with Matt Clark from Push Suspension next week.